Welcome to Rapids Fire, the Accelerated Data Science Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Mahler. And happy 2021. My co-host is going to be Bartley Richardson, Engineering Manager of AI Infrastructure, NVIDIA, and Rachel Allen, Senior Cybersecurity Data Scientist. They're going to be talking to us about their career journeys, the intersection of cybersecurity and data science, and really exciting technology that they have developed using Rapids to solve a lot of very vexing problems in the cybersecurity space, with applications to natural language processing in general. I hope you like this, and I'll be back at the end. Bartley, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Paul. Glad to be here.
Before we introduce our guest, I'd like to know a little bit about your career journey. Was cybersecurity always your passion, and how did you end up here today?
Yeah, that's a great question, Paul. I get asked that question a lot. And the short answer for our listeners is I kind of fell into it, right? So backing up, before NVIDIA, I taught, I was a CS professor for a while, with a focus on research, including logical query optimization for unstructured and loosely structured data. Eventually kind of wanted to move on. I got involved with some DARPA research, so I was on a few large DARPA research projects, and that's where I got introduced to cybersecurity. One of the projects, they collected a lot of PhDs from various different kind of areas, right? Economics, physics, computer science, all of them. Kind of put us in a room and was like, go solve cybersecurity team, which is, it turns out, is hard. And so we did a lot of learning on the fly. We kind of learned from experts that way. It was true learn by immersion. And it's really there that I just realized the breadth and the scope of the problems that are in modern cybersecurity. So really kind of from there, went on to a couple other DARPA projects, got involved with some work inside the intelligence community. I then found my way over to Rapids, where now I lead a team who's focused solely on applied research and development for turning GPU compute towards this large problem of cybersecurity. So came from this kind of consulting background. And Rachel, I know you kind of came from at least a similar type of background. I don't know if you want to go into a little bit of your background.
Sure. I started, I guess, a similar winding path. As an undergrad, I studied computer science and cognitive science. I have a PhD in neuroscience. And I went from a postdoc studying image processing in the brain to being really interested in deep learning and data science. And I went to work for a large government contractor with lots of data science projects, Booz Allen. And I was drawn towards applied data science for cybersecurity. It's kind of like the most interesting application of AI and ML. There's just a lot of untapped potential. We can talk about some of the NLP applications, graph networks, things like that. And so once I was there working on a few different cybersecurity projects embedded with the Advanced Threat Hunt team. And then I found my way over to Rapids, where we could focus more on the GPU acceleration of these cybersecurity applications.
Very good. I think that Bartley, as a data scientist, has a unique background, at least for the time that I've been in data science. Most people don't have computer science PhD. Rachel, I have met a few data scientists that come from backgrounds like yours. What difficulties or, you know, delights did you find in moving from what had been your academic background into something that used similar skills, but was quite different from what you'd spent your time up until working studying?
Yeah, that it actually was quite an adjustment, but not for the reasons a lot of people think. So my computer science background was almost purely theoretical computer science. Meaning at the time when I was going through college, I really disliked programming. I didn't like it. And so I focused all of my research and all of my effort around this kind of structure of mathematical proofs, being able to come up with new algorithms and prove them mathematically so that I didn't have to prove them experimentally. And so when I was in the computer science world, that's really what I focused on. So I had a really great grasp of mathematics and probability and statistics, but actually it was my fundamental programming that needed some brushing up and needed some kind of updating. it's kind of, as I talk to other people in the field, that's not been their typical journey, at least for some other computer scientists I've known. They've all had the programming down and needed help on some of the other aspects. And so for me, it was really just that, how do I program fast? And how do I get these really fast POCs done and then continue iterating on that? Rachel, what was your experience?
I found that, when I was in the biological sciences, kind of right around when AlexNet did really well on the ImageNet competition and CNNs were accelerated on GPUs. And I had kind of this desire to follow that path. And that's just kept leading me one step after another to, where is this most needed? Where can we get like the most out of accelerating deep learning on and data science? And I think, it's you can pull on that thread like throughout my career. I remember in undergrad doing neural network modeling in MATLAB. And I was like, this is so cool, but it takes 3 weeks for this to happen. And now it's just like blows me away how much we can do and how quickly we can do it. And it's just really fun to see like the progress over time, even though I've kind of haven't been in this exact field for as long as other people.
Bartley, in a post on the Rapids Medium page a little bit more than a year ago now, you had said that the cybersecurity workflow really is the data science workflow. Is this something that you would say is a recent step in the evolution of cybersecurity, or do you think that at its core, the cybersecurity process has always been a data science process?
I think to answer your last question, we can start there. I think it's always been that. We just didn't know what data science was at the time, right? We didn't have this definition. We didn't have this job. So when you look at what our data scientists doing, they're essentially doing the same workflow, right? They're taking a lot of data, they're trying to make insights from that data, and they're trying to join that data with other data sets. They're trying to do this enrichment. And that's really what analysts are trying to do. They're trying to do it for a different reason. They're either doing a forensic investigation, after the fact to figure out what happened, or they're doing some type of threat hunting to see what's inside of their network that they don't know about, or trying to root out what is inside their network. But they deal with these large volumes of data. They want to do these iterations, these query filter pivots over and over and over again. And then at the end of the day, they need to communicate that to somebody, whether it's their, the SOC manager, or whether that goes all the way up to the CISO or someone at the VP or the C-suite level. And so if you look at what data scientists do and what an analyst does, it's very, very similar in that regard.
Rachel, how do you think the toolkit for cybersecurity data scientist is different than what I guess I would call a regular data scientist, if that means anything anymore?
I would say, cybersecurity data comes in lots of different forms. You can have it be a regular quote unquote data scientist and you're focused on, maybe some SQL tables or some image processing, but cybersecurity, kind of like Bartley hit on, you're going to pivot from all different types of data streams, and they're all coming at you very quickly. There's a large volume of data, and there's very little labeled data or training data as opposed to regular data science. So it's really challenging to kind of find the needle in the haystack and know even when what pieces of the puzzle you need to put together to actually find what you're looking for. So if you sit, I was, embedded with this advanced threat hunting team and trying to get into their thought process as to how they can dig down into like an alert to see if this is malicious or not. They have like 10 to 15 different tabs open and they're cross-referencing lots of different things. So it's a very complex task. And I think that only leaves like more space for data science tools to like help with these subtasks rather than try to replace some sort of analyst. You just kind of want to speed up their process because we're nowhere close to replacing analysts.
And what Rachel hit on there, Paul, is really key. You can kind of, you can break it down a lot of different ways, but one way what Rachel was kind of getting at is to break it down as we can speed up the analyst, or we can kind of speed up their workflow, help them triage better, accelerate what the human is already doing, or we can try to kind of take new and drastically different approaches towards cybersecurity. And so we're always trying to walk this line between, are we building these, you know, more intelligent, you know, MLDL type systems to replicate what an analyst is doing? And there's pluses and minuses to that. Or are we building them to find the spots that an analyst isn't seeing, right? To augment the analyst. And there, you kind of have to walk this line between those two. They're both useful, but they both have their kind of drawbacks as well.
Earlier, you'd used a couple of acronyms. One was SOC and one was CISA. I believe CISA is Chief Information Security Officer, but what is SOC?
Yeah, sure. So a SOC, SOC stands for Security Operations Center.
How do you think a data scientist fits into the traditional structure of a cybersecurity team? Because this is something that companies have done for a very long time. And so I imagine that, as you said, the roles were very similar, but I think that as things become more specialized, I'd like to hear your thoughts on how a cybersecurity data scientist fits into or changes the existing structure of these units.
Whatever kind of structure we're talking about, there's typically a tiering structure in them. So there would be like maybe a tier one, tier two, tier three analyst. And all that really kind of relates to is kind of amount of experience and kind of how capable that analyst is. So as you grow as an analyst, you would move from tier one to tier two to tier three. And the tier one analyst is kind of the person that, like, this is a gross exaggeration, but the red light goes off and they look at what's happening and they decide, is this a thing that needs to be elevated or is it not a thing that needs to be elevated? As you get more and more up that chain to go to kind of manager level and kind of those senior people, those are the ones that are making the decisions. And kind of in the middle, you have the people doing like what Rachel and I were talking about, all these different kind of enrichments and reducing the walls between these silos. A lot of that work at the middle and a lot of how these alerts are getting into the SOC and being kind of propagated to these dashboards are all done by kind of hard and fast rules. Now, this is changing over the last couple of years, which is a good thing. But a lot of alerting is still done on rules, which means that, you know, to take a really simple example, if I have a piece of malware, I've observed this malware somewhere in the wild or a company has, they've written a complex set of rules that I can put into a pipeline and detect if this malware comes through this pipeline. And if that happens, you get this alert that kind of fires off. And so where the issues here are obvious, right? If you have something that you haven't seen before, you don't have a rule for it, you can't defend against it. It's very similar to, you know, if I can make a parallel to, you know, our human immune system or any kind of immune system, right? You haven't seen this before. I don't know how to defend against this thing. So one way that a data scientist or a cybersecurity data scientist, InfoSec data scientist, whatever kind of name we come up with for them, one way they can help is kind of create these more generic models. So instead of looking at, you know, traffic coming in and comparing it to an allow list or deny list, they're making models that can kind of infer what the content of this is. Rachel mentioned NLP. That's one of the approaches that we take. There's a lot of other types of approaches. To give a more concrete example, you know, we look at things like domain generating algorithms. And what these are in a nutshell is if you have a piece of malware on your system, it needs to make a callback somewhere rather than hard coding IP addresses, which can easily be blocked, or hard coding domain names, which can also easily be blocked. There's typically an algorithm that will generate continuously new domain names. At the other end, the attacker would have the same algorithm. They would continuously register these new domain names. And then you kind of evade. You're one step ahead of detection. But there are techniques that are not rule-based that use things like as simple as LSTMs that can tell you if this domain name was likely generated by one of those algorithms or not. So where I really see data scientists in the SOC is working with them and expanding their capability. You know, there's a huge person shortage in cybersecurity. And so none of this is taking jobs away from analysts because we don't have enough analysts for all of the jobs. So millions of empty cybersecurity roles that we can't fill. And so it's about giving them better context. It's about giving them better tools. And one type of better tool we can get them is like these DGA tools. You know, I'm just using that as an example, but it's these more generalizable tools and this more generalizable toolkit.
I've asked a lot of questions about general cybersecurity so far, but this is Rapids Fire, and I'd like to pivot now to talking about the intersection of Rapids and cybersecurity. Rachel, can you tell me a little bit more about the pre-built example workflows in Qlix? For our listeners, that's Qlix spelled C-L-X.
Sure. So we have in our repo, the Qlix repo for CyberLog accelerators, we have a couple different workflows that can hook up to your data streams, and you can just put your Rapids accelerated data science right from the notebook that you're building it out into one of these workflows. And we have an alert flow analysis. So if you're seeing high volumes of alerts, like they do in most SOCs, you might not necessarily pay any attention to your unprioritized alerts. So unless it's high, you're not going to drill down on it. But we have different ways of looking at the volume of these alerts that are coming in and cross-referencing them with each other so that we can draw your attention to maybe a medium alert or a low priority alert or an unprioritized alert that you might not have seen the first round. And we have a couple different examples of these workflows. They take advantage of, you know, very straightforward data science techniques like a rolling Z score to look at the volumes of different things over time. We have a periodicity detection that you can use. So if you're concerned about beaconing, be able to catch that if you were piping some of your data through our periodicity detection workflow. And then we also are exploring, you know, obviously different ways to label individual logs that come in. So we have a couple different NLP applications to logs as well that can hook up using our workflows.
I'm glad you mentioned logs, the main event in this podcast. One of the most insane things I was ever asked to do as a consultant involved logs. And the data that was provided to me by the client was literally 15 years of Oracle failure logs, and they wanted to find what was causing a kernel panic. It turned out they had a very special flavor of Unix, and that was a feature and not a bug. All this is to say, I was very happy that I did not need to try to somehow translate these very large Oracle failure logs into something useful for data science. Can both of you kind of set the stage about what is so challenging about working with logs? And historically, what are the challenges that you face using logs as a data source?
Paul, that's a whole, we could do a series of podcasts, right? logs are the worst. They are the worst. And I tell you what, every person we talk to about this, you know, they eventually understand, you know, especially if they haven't had any, you know, experience, you know, like your experience, right, will make you hate logs. Immediately, if they haven't any experience, they just look at you and you're like, that's a solved problem. I don't get it. It's not exciting. It's already solved. We have things for this. And then you go in a little bit more detail and they're like, this is a mess. This is terrible. Someone has to do something about this. And they're absolutely right. Right. There's so many problems with logs. I won't take all of them because I want Rachel to jump in as well. I'll just come up with a few of them. One is that they're constantly changing and they're constantly evolving. Right. So if I have a log that I can parse today, right, how do we typically parse logs? We write complicated regex, which stands for regular expressions, which are rules, rule-based log parsing that kind of pick out the pieces of information we need from that log. And every time we have a new log type, or every time we update the log, or the vendor updates the log, or every time there's an error in some of the formatting of the log, or every time the log is malformed, or every time, like yourself, you might want to compare logs from different years across different versions, across different output types, right? Where the actual data coming through in the log might be very different from version to version. You need to write a new rule, and you better hope that rule doesn't break. And this requires massive amounts of person power to do this, to not only to write them, but to maintain them. And that's one of the issues with logs. Another issue with logs is they don't have to conform to any particular standard, right? Yeah, there's JSON and there's CSV and there's all these things, but that's not how logs have to be, right? They can be English text. There's certain types of cybersecurity logs, which has some of it looks like key value pairs, but then the rest of this log is just English sentence, right? It's like this machine did X at this time. The alerts that fired were this. It's like you're reading a book, the book of the log, right? And these types of logs are very, very challenging to parse in kind of an easy and accessible way, right? It requires a lot of maintenance of these kind of handwritten, hand-tuned rules. I tend to refer to them as kind of bespoke log parsing, right? Where you're writing all of these different rules. Rachel, I know you've had equally frustrating experiences with logs and have your own thoughts about what makes them so terrible.
I feel like, you know, there's some classic quote about professional life is just saying that things you find painful are actually opportunities. And I think in that regard, logs provide just, you know, a really great opportunity. The experiences I've had, just like Bartley said, the changes over time, or just, you know, the volume of logs and not knowing exactly which parts are useful in any way, especially with error logs. And writing regex itself is incredibly painful. So yeah, I think it's a huge pain point. When I worked with the threat hunt team, when we brought on a new client, we would take several weeks spinning up an environment for them, going through all of their different vendors and the data that they were collecting to have it conform to a common data format so that then we could feed it into our ML models. And, you know, even using the heuristic Bartley talked about earlier, you need all that data to be in the form that you like to see it. And so you can look across, oh, we're getting, you know, some information is coming from this Cisco ASA firewall, and we can't compare it to anything coming from our Palo Alto firewall because, you know, the format's different. So it's kind of the first stop in doing anything at all with your data, whether it's, you know, machine learning or just like querying through it.
It was a pretty bold idea to take BERT and then use it to parse logs. And I want to know what inspired you to do so. And did you imagine it would be as successful as it has been when you began your research?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. So the inspiration is how terrible log parsing is. And I think for us, since a lot of the cool, fancy things that we want to do with these logs after we figure out how to parse them involves GPUs anyway, it seems like if we're not intimidated by the size of BERT, we should see how well it can perform on this not natural language task, but more, you know, cyber language task. And I had seen the success of BERT applied to lots of different not so natural language tasks. You know, that you can use it in medical research. You can imagine that the medical field has their own kind of sub language filled with medical acronyms. And so there's kind of there's a bio BERT kind of for that. And there's, I don't know, dozens and dozens and dozens of BERT. And it seemed like the bleeding edge of where natural language was headed when we started this a year ago. And I was pretty surprised that it performed better than some of the like LSTM approaches that we had tried before. But I guess it's also not surprising because it's really powerful with how much training goes in just to the model in the first place. And just, I think an added bonus is that because the model is pre-trained and contains so much information for transfer learning, I think what was the most surprising was how little data we needed to train it on a specific task downstream.
How much data are we talking about?
The data that we need to fine tune it for like a specific downstream task, you probably, you know, on the magnitude of 10,000 logs.
Oh, wow.
But the initial, you know, BERT model is trained on gigabytes of data.
Yeah, the BERT model, I encourage users who haven't heard of it before to look it up. I think they should look up Cybert first, but I will leave that to our listeners to decide for themselves. Bartley, you wrote a Medium post about something that had come out of the journey that your team has taken with BERT. It was on the GPU subword tokenizer. What motivated that? And tell us a little bit about where that fits into the ecosystem and potentially other uses it might have outside of cybersecurity as well.
When we put this end-to-end pipeline together, we realized very quickly that the pain point in terms of throughput through the system was in the tokenization. And it's because we had to rely on the CPU to do this tokenization. So the idea was, like our idea with most things, is, well, what if we get the data to the GPU faster, right? We take that tokenization step away from the CPU and we move it over to the GPU. And so that required this GPU subword tokenizer, which didn't exist before. And not only did it require it to be on the GPU, it requires it to be fast, right? Because you don't want to have a backlog of all these logs you're trying to parse. You want to be able to keep up with how well the inference is doing. So it required it to be fast. And it also required it to, because it required it to have a few features that maybe some other tokenizers don't have. And that's because we're not doing something like question answering, right? We're doing what's really more akin to named entity recognition. And the classic example is, right, we can label, you know, subject, verb, places, things, names, all those types of things. And what we're doing is with CyberLogs, we're essentially giving the values names. We're saying that's a source IP address. This is an event code. This is a domain name. You know, this is a username, all of these types of things. So we're doing this named entity recognition task. And as part of the kind of log parsing, these individual logs are broken up because we only have a max width in this tensor. So they're broken up, but we need to reconstruct them on the other side. So this subword tokenizer also needed to support things like metadata, which allows us to essentially stitch these broken logs back together when we're on the other side of inference. So we kind of keep that metadata around. So the kind of reason that we made it was we needed a GPU accelerated way to do it to keep up with the rest of the pipeline. And we ended up making something that's actually quite applicable, right? So it actually has some uses. The nice thing about it is it can do any type of BERT tokenization, and it also can do tokenization for Electra models as well. So if you're doing, you know, straight up natural language processing or kind of speech recognition or things like that, and you're using a BERT model or you're using an Electra model or any kind of model that uses subword tokenization, you can use this tokenizer. And we've had interest from a few other teams, including speech recognition teams, about using it. Because up until this point, the main way to tokenize has always been on the CPU.
You all have made a lot of progress over the last year. Rachel, you just recently published a blog on our Medium page on Cybert 2.0 with your colleague Bianca Rhodes. I believe that now it accommodates streaming. Could you tell us a little bit more about Cybert 2.0 and what's changed over the year that it's been worked on?
Sure. Yeah. So we made a few changes. One, training pipeline chunks your training in and starts and stops at different places so that we're assuring that your trained model isn't learning any absolute positions. It's just learning the relative positions, which has helped performance a lot. We've also supported, like Bartley said, can do distill BERT or Electra models. And we've added our trained models to the Hugging Face repo. So you don't have to start from scratch. You can go on there and just start with one of our pre-trained models. We also added integration with KubeStreams, which is the streaming pipeline to accelerate reading from Kafka. So we can get our logs to the GPU even faster and monitor them through this streaming pipeline end to end.
So Rachel, we've talked a lot about the pipeline of Cybert, and definitely there's a need to train and fine tune. You mentioned that, you know, our pre-trained models are available on Hugging Face for people to get started with. And that's a great way for them to get started. And when they download those models and kind of look at the streaming example that we have in the Clicks repo, they're going to be more in inference mode, right? What we would call log parsing mode. Can you talk a little bit about how the inferencing pipeline is with maybe mentioning as well kind of the metrics that we emit from Cybert while inferencing?
For Q streams, right, your data is going to come in and it's going to go right into that RAPIDS environment where we can leverage the subword tokenizer and other pre-processing string functionality that you can find using QDF. And then from the QDF, it gets turned into tensors that then goes through our PyTorch model. And then on the after it goes through the inference of the model, we need to stitch the pieces back together. So it takes a label for each one of these tokens and puts it in the appropriate column name. So you turn your string into data frame. And along with this data frame that has your parsed outputs, each cell contains a confidence score. So this is like such a great feature. Unlike regular regex parsing, they really don't have any way to monitor like how well it's doing or how it's changing over time. Cybert has this built-in functionality of confidence score. So you get confidence score for each element that you're parsing, but also you an average for that whole row. So you can look at how maybe you could set up an alert using our rolling Z score to see that, oh, you know, your confidence in your parsing has really gone down and maybe something happened, you know, with your log collection, or you've added a new type of log or something has happened in your stream. So the output then that you can send back out of Kafka contains like this built-in monitoring.
And that's really a big deal, right? Rachel kind of, I like how Rachel's like, oh yeah, and we do this kind of thing, but you know, she's almost downplaying it, right? She's downplaying her work. It's really a big deal. It opens up all of these avenues for being able to continuously monitor your various streams of data. And because it's happening on the GPU, we can take advantage of that massive parallelization to do things like Rachel said. We can roll Z-scores across every value, every log that you're getting, right? Just these confidence scores are so granular that you can roll them up to the entire log, but we also emit them, like Rachel said, down to the individual value in every log. So every value that's getting parsed in every log that you're seeing gets a confidence score. So if you're more concerned about something, these type of log or these types of values, like I know my IPs have to be parsed correctly, you can set that condition monitoring up in your environment. It also helps you know when you might need to fine tune your model again or retrain. And so it really is a great feature. Whereas before, if you're trying to figure this out with kind of standard tools, you're almost doing it after the fact, right? You're doing like an audit or a forensic type analysis of it. And this, we're hoping, helps move people closer to, you know, the event that happened and to adjust their logging as necessary.
Just to build one more thing on that is that it also makes it really resilient. So even if your log is degraded, we'll still output, you know, what we presume is the most likely value for each of these fields. And you'll know that, you know, the confidence is going down, but you'll still get that value, which is inherently better than regex, which just fails without letting you know.
That all sounds really amazing, frankly. And for people that are listening that work in cybersecurity, that maybe are hearing about this for the first time, I'd like to get both of your thoughts on how they can get started.
The easiest way to get started is to visit the repo. We are a sub repo in RAPIDS, so github.com/rapidsai. Clicks is right there. You can look inside the repo. We have an end-to-end streaming example with streams that Rachel talked about. We also have examples in Jupyter Notebook. So if you want to kind of get started that way, you can as well. Like Rachel mentioned, we have a pre-trained model on Hugging Face that you can download, or we also provide the capability to fine-tune your own model. So if you want to start and build your own model, we give that capability as well. Rachel, do you have any kind of first pointers for them? Like they go to the repo, they look at all the stuff we have. What would be the first thing that you would look at or first thing you would do?
So I would check out, we have a notebooks folder, which is nice. You can see kind of all the different use cases that we've been working on. And even if you don't have the environment set up yet, you can scroll through our notebooks and pick the direction that you want to get started in the notebooks directory.
So Rachel, we've talked a lot about Cybert and how it's evolved over the past year. What are the next steps for Cybert and this idea of using NLP on logs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I feel like we're just scratching the surface of what's possible with NLP applied to cyber logs. So we talked about parsing, but I think there's a couple different use cases that we've been exploring and researching with internal teams and other companies that we've been collaborating with. One of them we've had a lot of success with is phishing detection. I think that makes sense because emails are really pretty close to natural language. Another thing that we're looking for, and Paul was talking about earlier, is this root cause analysis, right? So if you have just, you know, massive amounts of error logs and you have some examples of lines in those logs that were interesting to you before, we can then build a model using that as training data. And what we found is that we can then highlight some error lines that were not previously being looked at, but have been really helpful for teams with their root cause analysis. We've also looked at using Cybert for PII scrubbing. This is not something, a model I think we could put on Hugging Face, because you're gonna wanna train it on your internal data with your own PII. But once you've done that with your own internal organization's data, it works really well for flagging PII things. We've also, with a couple groups that have really fast regex parsers that they enjoy using, and their pain point is actually knowing which regex parser to send the log to. For this, instead of parsing the log, we're actually just using it for identification. So if we can tell you that this log is a Cisco ASA firewall, you can then send it downstream to the appropriate regex parser. So we found our way into a lot of different pipelines over the last year. It seems like every day we're talking to someone about their pain point and thinking how we can apply a language model to it.
Yeah. And those are all great. And I should mention, they're all coming to Qlix or already are in Qlix. So if we're, you know, Rachel mentioned phishing detection, that's in Qlix right now. It uses, you know, this NLP based approach for phishing detection. You can fine tune it and tune it to your own network. And that's really kind of at the core of a lot of what we do. To kind of wrap things up is we believe very strongly in this idea of customized AI for cybersecurity. Instead of saying, I'm going to make one tool that kind of solves everyone's problems, we really want to empower the people that know their network the most, the individuals working in the SOC, the security analyst, the cybersecurity data scientist, all the way up to the people making decisions at the organization. Giving them the tools and empowering them to be able to write customized software for their network, because they know their network the best, and they know what they care about, and they know where their security holes and where their security issues and their concerns lie. I think is really the model for the future. And this idea of being able to put work out there that people can take and customize and use on their network is really exciting to me. That's one of the joys of open source software, is being able to put that work out there, getting feedback on it, and letting people take it and run with it. And I'll give my pitch here. We're always looking for contributors. We're always looking for cybersecurity individuals and data scientists who are inclined to tackle cybersecurity problems, that want to co-develop with us and submit issues and submit features to Qlix. So if that's you, or if you have any interest in that, please hit us up on GitHub or find us on find Rapids on Twitter or the Rapids homepage, and we would love to get connected and work with you.
I believe people can also find both of you on Twitter. I think this is a natural place to wrap things up. I want to thank our guests, Bartley Richardson and Rachel Allen. Thank you very much for your time. I learned a lot during the session.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
I want to thank Bartley and Rachel again for their time and their insight into how they're using RAPIDS and artificial intelligence to solve a longstanding and very vexing problem in cybersecurity and how they are accelerating cybersecurity data science in general. We'll have another episode of RAPIDS Fire 2 weeks from now, releasing on Tuesday. But in the meantime, we're going to have a special discussion with Rachel about artificial general intelligence. Because her background is in cognitive neuroscience, I thought that she would have interesting insights to share, and we thought you would enjoy the episode. So look for that next Tuesday. Please remember to subscribe to our podcast wherever you get it. If you like our podcast, please give it 5 stars. If you don't like our podcast, please reach out to me on Twitter @RealPaulMahler. Until next time.